Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening. Indeed, the Word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing until it divides soul from spirit, joints from marrow. It is able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart, and before him no creature is hidden, and all are naked and laid bare to the eyes of the one to whom we must render an account. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need.
There's never been a day when the world wasn't new, when the sun did not rise or the light break on through. Things might get a little worse before they get a little better, but there's always clear skies stretching out beyond bad weather, and the world holds its breath just to see we're inclined this time. Ha la la la, ha la la la, ha la la la.
Clear eyes, full hearts. We're going to have to work on that later. Really, nobody. Clear eyes, full hearts. Oh, that's a little bit of hope right there. A little bit of hope. We're going to come back to that, but that helps me. There was an article in the New York Times right after the vice presidential debate, and the person, the writer, his name is Michael Shear, and the title is "Show of Teeth Spurs a Debate Over Biden." I love that title. Right after the debate, this is what he wrote. "The clash seemed to energize liberals. A commentary on Daily Cause, a liberal blog, concluded that Mr. Biden delivered an eviscerating performance and demonstrated deep knowledge, huge heart, and brutal honesty during the debate." And so that was one side. And then on the other, Tim Miller, a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee, helped kick off a drumbeat of criticism over Mr. Biden. The hashtag that they started up was Biden Unhinged. Some folks know what Twitter is, and even if you don't, you get it. Biden Unhinged. We live in a moment in time when people could sit on the exact same couch and watch something happen right in front of them, and someone would say, "He was phenomenal, he was terrible." And the person sitting right next to them would say, "He was phenomenal and he was terrible." And they would mean the opposite person. Some of you might be sitting next to someone who you are on a couch with at various times, and you might be that couple. You might be those folks. I know whenever I head home, my dad and I sit next to one another on the couch, but we couldn't be farther apart in how we see the world. And maybe you have people in your life that that are like that. But guess what? They think you're like that too. At least I know my dad would say I am in that way. Last week, Linda's message helped us to hold this reality that God holds for us, that we are all in this together. We are all beloved children of God. We phrase it here at the table as all means all. That is the place that we find ourselves, but what we hear and what happened right after the debate, and I actually want to pause to say, I thought the debate was pretty substantive And I thought it was pretty, it was the best that I had seen of two people sharing their deeply contrasting worldviews and policies. But really what I want to hold is seconds after the debate ends, the blogosphere and the Twittersphere just blows up with demonizing, with demolishing. Folks are like taking swords and throwing them and taking cover. And the truth is, and the libertarians and the Green Party folks and folks that refuse this whole system will disagree with me, but the truth, it seems to me, is that we live in a moment where there's two teams, and these two teams really, they dislike each other. I'll even use the word that they hate each other at various moments and at various times. That seems undeniable to me, that like wherever you are, whichever team you colors you put on, red or blue or something totally different, it seems undeniable to me that we live in a moment in time where these different sides can see the exact same thing happen and they find themselves in totally different understandings of what they've just seen. It just seems that way. So you turn on the television and it doesn't help, it just recreates this dichotomy. You turn on the red team, Fox News, and you hear endless bashing of how weak the blue team is. And then you turn on the blue team, MSNBC, and you just hear how terrible the red team is. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. And it got me thinking this week a lot about teams. And there's a television show that was about teams, and one of them happened to be blue, and the other one happened to be red. But it's called Friday Night Lights. And I want to move into a little bit of that story because I hope it can help us understand otherness, difference, and to reflect on how God might be calling us in the midst of that. But before I do it, the places that I think we're living mostly are what I would identify, in the words of Parker Palmer, as ego stories. So an ego story is this. If you think of yourself going into a party for the very first time, and someone comes up to you and they say, "What do you do?" You try to tell them your ego story. If you're Coach Taylor, you say, "I'm a football coach. We won a state title." And in Texas, that's the biggest ego story anybody can tell. And that's the place that it ends. See, our ego stories are usually, they're pros. Ego stories usually use numbers. They define and they have nice resolutions. They're linear. So if Coach Taylor were to tell an ego story, it would be, "I inherited this ragtag group of folks. I tore them down, I built them up, and we together won a state championship." That's the ego story. But if you've seen Friday Night Lights, you know that there's all kinds of stuff going on underneath that. And it's the same thing in our own lives. We might say to someone, "I'm a brand new attorney. I just passed the bar." Isn't that awesome? "I'm a brand new attorney. I just passed the bar. I have a job." And at the same moment, underneath that lies the soul story. The searching throughout those school times and into the unknown of, "Am I going to pass the bar?" And then the real uncertainty of, "Will I find work at this time?" Parker Palmer defines those as our soul stories. Soul stories are so deep that most of the time they come to us in poetry or in visual arts or in music. Soul stories don't work in this linear way, and they also don't have tight resolution. Soul stories take us into the deepest places of our hearts, and we're there. See, at 3 a.m., or when we're near our death, we don't tell our ego stories. We hold on to those soul stories because they take us through. Those soul stories carry us on. And Friday Night Lights has become a political touch point in the last couple of days because the campaigns have used its slogan, "Clear eyes, full hearts." Come on, people. Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. They've used this as a way to gather their team together to say, "Here we are, one against many. Let's rise up and go." Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose, the ego side. But you know what? There is a deep soul story underneath this little fictitious television show about Texas, which may for many of us be very other. And so I want to watch for just a moment this clip from compilation of clips from Friday Night Lights.
You listen to me closer than you've ever listened to me before.
Listen to yourself.
You got a heart, charisma, and a lot of skill.
You should feel real proud.
I believe you can do anything you put your mind to.
You can't beat yourself up because you're taking chances on things.
Every man at some point in his life is going to lose a battle.
You're dealing with it. You're doing what you're supposed to do. You're being a man about it.
This is all yours to take. It depends on how much you want it.
You've earned this, the right to win. You put that in your head.
It's time for you to give the best you got.
Let me tell you something.
There's a joy to this game, is there not?
Yes, sir.
This is a game we are going to win.
This is the game that people are going to talk about for years to come.
And I'm asking you right here, right now,
right now,
right here.
Right now.
Right here.
This is it, right here, right now.
You got a job to do. Nothing else. This is within your reach.
And I can promise you I won't stop until you get there.
You deserve this, you understand?
Do your best.
Let me just ask you one question. Can you play like champions?
How much are you willing to sacrifice yourselves out in this field?
Because I promise you, they're going to come at you with everything they've got.
And this is our time. This is your time. I want you to know I'm proud to take the field with you.
I have never been more proud of a team than I am right now.
You be proud of yourselves, because gentlemen, you are champions.
Take that with you, carry it, and we're gonna build on it.
Let's go get them.
They're done.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose.
Let's hear it, gentlemen. Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose.
Let's go play some football. Let's go, baby.
There's not a single person in this room that's ever going to be the same.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Yeah, we'll deal with that later.
And the later might be now. This is one of those shows that if you watch it from a red place, you see what you want to see. And if you watch it from a blue place, you see what you want to see. And I find this show is one of the few that maybe flips them upside down and turns them around. And it makes us wonder, because it takes us into really deep, hard questions about wealth and poverty in rural Texas, about race and racism in rural Texas. And guess what? We might see that as other, but those are our issues right here in urban California. Parker Palmer, in his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, he invites us to go back to the core of what is democracy. Not the fighting that we experience so frequently in our day, but the core of what democracy is about. And he says it in this way. In this book, the word heart reclaims its original meaning. Heart comes from the Latin core and points not merely to our emotions, but to the core of the self, that center place where all of our ways of knowing converge. Intellectual, emotional, sensory, intuitive, imaginative, experiential, relational, and bodily, among others. The heart is where we integrate what we know in our minds with what we know in our bones. The place where our knowledge can become more fully human. Core is also the Latin root from which we get the word courage. Core, courage. When all that we understand of self and world comes together in the center place called the heart, we are more likely to find the courage to act humanely on what we know. And I think it's that core that Coach Taylor is taking his young athletes into when he says, clear eyes, full hearts, and they say, can't lose. The campaigns, they've adopted that slogan, but I think in doing so, they're living up in these ego stories and missing the depths of where that actual show takes us. Coach Taylor himself was part of a blue team for a while, and then he moved to a red team, Dillon and East Dillon. But the storyline that this show always pushes causes us to wonder about who in our life is other. who in our life is on the other side of the tracks? And how are we going to encounter that? How will we be when we experience that other? See, the show isn't just about getting fired up to go play a football game. It's about what is underneath the stories of our lives, our soul stories. From various places, this show challenges us to see otherness. It's white student athletes encountering African American student athletes. It's poor families looking across the way at wealthy families. It's adults in positions of power encountering teenagers who feel overwhelmed by the pressures to conform. The ego stories are easy to kind of just gloss over, these relationships, if we were to stay in those ego stories. But at its best, this show takes us underneath them, about what's happening as we encounter otherness and the moments in our lives where we try to crush it and the moments in our lives where we allow our hearts to be opened to learn from someone that we see as other than ourselves. And so when I was preparing for this morning, there was a biblical scholar who helped me think a lot about this. And the way she talked about it is the word empathy. The word empathy doesn't show up anywhere in the New Testament. The Greek word does not. But it seems to her, and I find this very compelling, that it's a central concept to faith and to Christianity, to following Jesus. And to understand how important empathy, embracing otherness, valuing otherness is in that day, I want to take us back to the ancient Greek world. And in that space, there was no way in which a god could empathize with humanity. It just did not happen. She writes about it this way. The experience of being a god was so different from the experience of being human that there was no possibility for either of them to truly understand the other. So there was no possibility for empathy. Gods could not relate to humans. They were completely other, and there was no possible way that line could be crossed. Simple separation. And so from that place, I want to invite you to hear these words from the letter to the Hebrews. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in time of need. So unlike those Greek understandings of God's being so other that the God could not relate to humanity, the followers of Jesus articulated a totally different worldview. That God is other. God is mysterious. God can't be put in a little box. You can't put the sacred in a little box because it's not. We just sang that. They believed that. And yet at the same moment, God sympathizes, God empathizes with creation so much that God chooses to enter into creation, to know as God is known. God enters into creation, and it's significant to me that God enters into creation in the feeding trough of an animal, in a rural place, to a teenage mom who was not wed. Because the ego story would like it to be God entered triumphantly into the world and a castle to a royal family. But that's not our story. Our story keeps turning it upside down and inside out in a world where God could not sympathize with humanity. God could not come to be human. The followers of Jesus said, it has happened. That God has come in the form of Jesus, Jesus as fully human and fully divine. In effect, Jesus is God empathizing with the human experience. And that is at the heart of this letter to the Hebrews. That God cares so deeply about God's creation, that God enters into the world in the form of a holy human being. And so we hold this paradox. God is other, mysterious, can't be placed in a box. And God is concrete, born in a manger to an unwed teen mom, turning the world upside down. And our call as followers of Jesus, as the person writing to these Hebrews, is to say, if we live so deeply in that, we can't help but recognize that God wants us to see the others around us and to be in relationship, not putting them in boxes either, but allowing ourselves to be in relationship with the concrete people, because it's the concrete that God comes into the world through, this small baby. And if you've ever been in those moments after birth, you can hold the beauty and the hope of this small child that is other from the mother who just gave birth, and also more deeply related than you can possibly fathom. That's the way that God comes into the world, and that's the way that the author of the letter of Hebrews wants us to see, that in that child is a vision of God's love, and it's other, it's different from us, and we're bound up in it. It's that dream that is the way that Jesus taught. And so there's a tension that we hold together, that we are in this together with all of God's creation, and we are continually reminded of how we learn from those that are other, just as we learn from a God who is other and interrupts our lives in the form of a child. Irenaeus says it this way: God became as we are in order that we might become as God is. God became as we are in order that we might become as God is. I think that's at the heart of this letter of to the Hebrews. But the truth is, we don't live there very often. The truth is, when we encounter otherness, most often we want to put it in a box. We want to make it like us, or we want to get away from it. Parker Palmer tells a story of his own learning about this as an organizer in a suburban community. And this community was growing, and it was becoming more and more diverse, and it was trying to embrace that diversity. What Parker Palmer realized was that the people who are most afraid of strangers are those who have the most limited experiences with people who are different from them. And we live in a world where we get segregated in all of those ways. And so we don't encounter otherness, political or so many different ways. And when our ancient fear of otherness is left unacknowledged, unattended, untreated, diversity creates dysfunctional communities. See, the benefits of diversity can be ours only if we hold our difference with respect, patience, openness, and hope, writes Palmer. Which means we must attend to the invisible dynamics of the heart, the core, if we're to heal the heart of democracy. Parker Palmer learned about this in one of the most unexpected places for him. He got into a taxi cab along Broadway in New York City, and he tried to ask the taxi cab driver, "What's it like? I'm guessing you have a pretty different cross-section of folks that get into this cab with you every day." If you've been up and down Broadway, you can imagine the cross-section of folks. And if you haven't, I'm sure you can imagine the cross-section as well. And the cab driver started to respond with enthusiasm. He started to gesture and to talk, and he was driving with no hands, and Parker Palmer started to get a little anxious. But if you've been in New York City very long, you know that's just how cab drivers drive. And the cab driver kept talking about it, and what he said was this: "You never know who's going to get into the cab, so it's a little dangerous. But you meet a lot of people. You get to know the public, which teaches you a lot in life. You don't know anything if you don't know the public. You exchange ideas and you learn a lot from people. It's like going to school, meeting all these different kinds of people, and everything helps. It never really hurts. If you only like one kind of people, it's just no good. We talk, and if I have a better idea, I'll tell them. And maybe they'll say yes, or maybe they'll say no. That's how I educate myself. It makes me happy. You can't buy this kind of education. If you're in with the same kind of people all the time, it's like wearing the same suit all the time. You just get sick of it." If we were to look at politics through the eye of the heart, we could see that we could be liberated from this chess game of moves, or Palmer writes, this whack-a-mole game of blame. See, rightly understood, politics is no game at all. It's the ancient and honorable human endeavor of creating community in which the weak as well as the strong can flourish. Love and power can collaborate, and justice and mercy can have their day. We the people must build a political life rooted in the commonwealth of compassion and creativity still found among us, becoming a civic community sufficiently united to know our own will and hold those who govern us accountable. This is our task in the weeks ahead as we approach a national election. It's going to be easy for all of us to be caught up in the bashing and the blaming. When we see otherness, to stay in our ego stories, or to try to take others out as we hear their ego stories. But what if we were to root our lives in compassion and creativity? I know that will be far more challenging. I think it takes us to that place of clear eyes and full hearts, not as a slogan, but as a deep truth about the soul stories that lie underneath who we are and how we are. We've held these first 2 weeks of this series, these two values of recognizing that we are all in this together and embracing the value of otherness. God, as the author of Hebrews reminds us, has done both of these. God sees God's children, God's creation, and loves. But God does not long for us to all be one, as in the same, but to be one, as in who we are, unique children of God. Jesus is the embodiment of that. God's otherness made concrete in a manger. May we have the courage, the heart, to see that in ourselves and in those that we find as other. In a poem called The Low Road by Marge Piercy, she writes it this way. It starts when you say we, and you know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. So with clear eyes and full hearts, may we each day say we and truly know who we mean, and each day may we mean one more. Amen.
We're going to move into prayer, and what that means here at the table is open, and I mean this. You may stay where you are. You may move around the sanctuary. And we are learning that as our numbers are growing, sometimes it feels uncomfortable to say, excuse me, when you're sitting on the end and someone in the middle wants to get out. So we do want to be sensitive to let people out if they need to move. And where might you move to? We have candles here on the side in the window. And one is a pillar and the other are tapers. Because sometimes the physical act of holding our prayer and lighting the candle and placing it in the sand helps with our intention to give that over to God. We want to invite you to consider, as we, you know, root our lives in grace, your own desire to say, as the poem said so well, to say we instead of just me. And what would it mean in your own life this week, each day, to encounter what feels to you as if it's the other, and to call that other we? You and me make a we. To consider the soul story that each of us carries, but as you go into prayer, consider your soul story, the one that sits in your heart that brings you to either a place of other or of we. And to offer that, to invite God into that place. And that's often just nothing more simple than acknowledging it silently in our own hearts. But sometimes we do want to kneel and pray about that. You'll hear the music, and that'll move us too. So let us be in prayer, all of us as a we.
All the poor and powerless, and all the lost and lonely, and all the thieves will come confess and know that you are holy, and know that you are holy.